Hello, listeners. This is your Franchise Festival host, Christian Skipper. Just giving you a quick heads up here at the top of the episode that we had some minor technical difficulties in this one, and Hamilton's mic is coming in a little hot and distorted. It's a new microphone, so we hope to have that resolved and even improve our audio quality in future episodes. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to Franchise Festival, where we take a deep dive into the history, story, and gameplay of individual entries in historically noteworthy video game series. For Season 1, we've been covering Nintendo's The Legend of Zelda. Our last episode, Episode 10, covered 2005's The Legend of Zelda: The Minish Cap. This episode, we're going to be stepping just a little bit further back in time, going a little bit out of chronological sequence, to cover The Legend of Zelda Four Swords and The Legend of Zelda Four Swords Adventures. Before getting started, though, we should probably introduce ourselves. As ever, I'm your host, Christian.
And I'm Hamilton.
I'm Spencer.
This episode, we don't have a sort of starting prompt, as we do sometimes, because we want to get right into the meat of things here. Four Swords was originally released on the Game Boy Advance. It appeared in the United States on December 2nd, 2002, and in Japan and Europe the following March in 2003. It was originally packaged in with The Legend of Zelda: A Link to the Past port for the Game Boy Advance. It would then be re-released, strangely enough, in 2011 as The Legend of Zelda: Four Swords Anniversary Edition, all on its lonesome, for the Nintendo DSiWare service, which players could get access to on the Nintendo DS or 3DS. And it was only available on that service from September 28th, 2011 through February 20th, 2012 in the West. 2 years later, in this continuing and very bizarre release saga, Four Swords Anniversary Edition was then re-released on the 3DS eShop, but only for about 5 days. From January 30th through February 2nd, 2014. Why any of that happened the way that it did, I could not find an answer for in researching this. There are some pretty significant enhancements to the DSiWare version. It has a single-player mode added. The graphics were slightly up-resed, so it looks a little bit nicer. It sounds a little bit nicer. The really cool thing is that its stages are doubled, because the original game had sort of more or less three full stages. The re-released version has three additional stages, which are based on the original Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past, and Link's Awakening. So pretty cool. Staff on Four Swords was largely comprised of Capcom employees. It was overseen on the Nintendo side by general producers Shigeru Miyamoto and Yoshiki Okamoto. This is a rare example of a post-Ocarina of Time Legend of Zelda game that Eiji Aonuma had no involvement with. He was in the process of directing Wind Waker at this time, and he hadn't yet become series producer, which he would become around 2004. The team at the Capcom side was led by Hidemaro Fujibayashi. He had previously worked on Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons, and would direct the Minish Cap next. The development process for Four Swords was pretty darn short, as you'd expect. It's a very truncated title. Very little information is available on it, unfortunately. Most of what we know from the Legend of Zelda Encyclopedia, which has all of maybe sort of two bullet points about how it got made, and a 2004 interview where Fujibayashi talks a little bit about it. As we talked about last time, Fujibayashi's team at Capcom was diverted from working on the Minish Cap to working on this multiplayer mode for Link to the Past's GBA port. Players who swapped between one and the other on the cartridge would find that Four Swords actually looked quite a bit different from Link to the Past. Though the landscape of Link to the Past is used as kind of the world that Link moves around in Four Swords, its character sprites are largely inspired by the Wind Waker. And this was part of a broader program at Nintendo to kind of unify the appearance of Link across various products in the 2000s. One of the advantages of having gone with more cartoony style on the GameCube's Wind Waker is that it could be more easily replicated on the GBA. So Link would look pretty similar as opposed to like the kind of weird off-model issues that permeated the series in the 1990s, where you have like purple hair Link in Link to the Past. You've got little like stocky cube Link in Link's Awakening. And then you have obviously polygonal Link in Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask. All right, Hamilton, why don't you take us through the story such as it is for Four Swords?
Sure thing. This is actually the first game where the evil wind sorcerer Vati makes his appearance. And that might seem weird because we just played the Minish Cap and we saw him there.
This is his first appearance, chronologically speaking, if you're playing the games in release date order, but it's his...
And you're playing a release game
exactly,
order, yes.
Yeah, it's his second like story appearance.
Right. And they do make reference to the fact that he does not remember his Minish form.
Oh, neat. I didn't catch that.
Yes, he doesn't remember his Minish form, nor does he remember his past. However, in this game, he is seeking out young maidens for reasons that even he doesn't particularly understand. But it would make sense based on when you play the games.
Yeah.
That's also another reason that Vati doesn't have a humanoid appearance in this game, because he actually technically didn't have a design for it then.
Yeah, the Capcom hadn't created what he would look like in Minish Cap yet, since this was developed first, yeah.
Yes, exactly. For those who are curious as to why he kind of shows up in his final form, bat, golem form.
Yeah, he's like a one-eyed flying people eater or something.
Exactly. Very interesting form. But at least in this game, in terms of story, so he's a sorcerer that was well known for causing havoc, assaulting villages, and as I just stated, kidnapping beautiful girls that he came by.
Body's creeping.
In the myth, however, there was one young boy who stated that he would defeat the sorcerer. Those were his words, and he was going to stick to it, and sure enough, he did. Somehow, he trapped the evil sorcerer within his sword and returned all the young girls to their respective villages. After he did so, he went into the forest and he disappeared, but left behind his blade. When asked how he defeated the sorcerer, when no one else could, the girl stated that with a wave of his sword, his body could split into four copies, and the four copies defeated the evil together. Legend gave the blade the name the Four Sword because of that, and had a shrine built to honor it.
And of course, folks who had played along with us last time and followed the Minish Cap, or for one reason or another encountered the Minish Cap before this game, are familiar with the origins of the Four Sword, as the Minish Cap serves as a prequel to this, explaining this this ancient myth of Vati in detail.
Mm-hmm. And actually, very similar to Minish Cap, Princess Zelda in this game is responsible for protecting the blades. And her actual most trusted friend is Link in this game.
Yeah, as ever, a different Zelda and a different Link.
Exactly. Now, for the story of this game, she felt that something was amiss. So she asked her best friend Link to accompany her so she could see what was wrong with the Four Sword. As it turns out, the seal did wink it over time. And Vati grabbed
the princess.
It's a
plumbing problem, yeah.
Yeah, it happens, you know.
Yeah.
These swords.
Yeah, we've all been there. You know, you got to fix a sink every once in a while, just like you got to fix a Four Sword.
They just don't make sacred swords like they used to, I swear.
Yeah, that's the truth.
But as the seal weakened over time, Vati did actually manage to kind of emerge from the sword and grabbed Princess Zelda for being a fair maiden.
He's basically like a fairy tale monster, you know?
Yeah. Like in this one, again, because of his defeat in Minish Cap, he lost a lot of memories, but he is kind of driven by an instinct Yeah. Which is one, to collect princesses or young maidens, because in the old game, he needed to collect Princess Zelda for the Light Force. But in this game, he's forgotten what the Light Force is.
Mm-hmm.
So he really doesn't know why he's doing it. He just knows that he needs to do it.
Yeah, he's like the zombies in Dawn of the Dead. You know, he returns to places that meant something to him to reenact a crude facsimile of what he once did intentionally.
Exactly. And to that end, it's a little interesting. Like, when you actually put the stories together, he's more or less trying to figure out what he was in the past. Thankfully, he never really does that, because Four Swords, the Game Boy Advance version, doesn't have a whole lot of story to go beyond that. Basically, you just need to attain the Four Sword, which you do automatically, which allows you to split into four different copies. You also have to prove yourself courageous enough before you faced off against Vati. And you do that throughout the course of your adventure.
Yeah, I love, like, who's setting up this trial, you know? Like, who's the referee who's like, oh yeah, Link's demonstrated his courage enough now, he can fight Vati.
Right, kind of the same thing in Wind Waker. I mean, I suppose you have the gods watching you, but I mean, I don't know. Here, it's just more like, you know, you need to build up your resume before you fight someone like Vati, let's be honest.
This is Link's got to add a few bullet points to his CV.
Yeah, this is your internship, so work hard.
Uh-huh.
Earn your place. And Link does accomplish what he needs to do. He faces up with Vati at the Wind Temple and successfully reseals him within the Four Sword and protects the world from evil.
And the world is safe forever until Four Swords Adventures.
Yeah, and that's kind of it for the story. Not deep, but hey, it's enough.
Yeah, like it functions as a skeletal outline to get the player to fight through several stages.
Exactly.
With regard to those stages, Spencer, why don't you walk us through how the gameplay in Four Swords works out?
Yeah, absolutely. So Four Swords is kind of a pretty far departure from the normal Zelda format. It's much more of an arcade style, reminiscent of something like Gauntlet Legends or presumably Gauntlet. I'm too young to pretend like I've played a lot of Gauntlet proper in my day.
But... a rare occasion when we get to talk about how young we are as opposed to how old we are.
Right?
Yeah. So this was, as we mentioned before, this was utilized Game Boy Advance and the Link cables. I believe each player had to have a copy of the game, correct?
That's my understanding as well. Mm-hmm. It's almost certainly true. Yeah.
Yeah. So design required at least two players, with each player controlling a different colored Link. A lot of the puzzles and gameplays revolved around the different players synchronizing, working together to lift heavier objects than normal. The goal was to progress through these randomly arranged stages. They weren't randomly generated, I don't believe. I'm pretty sure they were preset, but just the order that they were given to you in any given level was randomized.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. Yeah, they're kind of, they're modular stages. You can tackle them, you can tackle the three central stages of the game in any order. And once you're in one of them, they're not tiles in the small style of Legend of Zelda or Link's Awakening. They're larger areas in the style of Link to the Past, but they fit together with other areas in sort of a modular way. So you get a slightly different experience each time you play it with your friends.
I'll apologize ahead of time. I'm going to be saying a lot of statements with the cadence of a question. I had some technical issues with Four Swords, so my knowledge of this game specifically comes from Let's Plays and Wiki Diving.
Yeah, and you know, I think it would be worth addressing that for a minute, because as we talked about, and you know, gameplay is a good place to do it, but as we talked about briefly in the history, Four Swords is extremely difficult to play. It was tricky to play at the time. It is much trickier to play now in the way that it was intended by its original creators. few people have a Game Boy Advance sitting around. Certainly, we make no claim to be professionals here, so we don't have a we don't have a deep bench of like historical game hardware. You know, we have a few consoles, but we certainly don't have a set of GBAs lying around. You need copies of the game, and then you need link cables between each of them, and you need everybody to be in person. It's pretty tricky to get a game of Four Swords going as Capcom intended in 2003. It is slightly easier to play the single-player variant at this distance in time. That said, the single-player variant effectively requires a hacked game console, or having gotten it during the extremely brief window that it was available for an original game console, because no physical edition was ever produced.
You know what's interesting is that I actually remember, because I have a Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, I actually have a copy of Link to the Past and Four Swords, the original cartridge. I just no longer have the Game Boy Advance to play it. Anyway, sorry.
And I actually have the Game Boy Advance to play it. But I do remember that being an issue. I remember when Four Swords Adventures came out and they kind of touted it like, here's a, you know, a super interesting, cool way for everyone to kind of have an adventure.
Yeah, it's the first multiplayer Zelda. Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Four Links, Four Adventures type thing, or whatever advertisements placement that they tried to use back in the day to kind of get you to buy Game Boy Advances and play this game. But I do remember that one of the complications was the fact that a lot of people just weren't particularly willing to buy a Game Boy Advance just to play this game with their friends.
Right, and you need the link cables.
And the link cables and stuff like that. And I just remember hearing just that's kind of one of the reasons why it just didn't really work out, because of that complication.
I did not have this game at the time. And I had no friends who had it, so we certainly didn't play it back then. So anyway, Spencer, sorry to sort of derail us there with a little bit of a, you know, an apology for how difficult it is to play Four Swords at this time.
Oh, I wanted to expand a little bit on what I mentioned when I said this is structured like an arcade
game. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's worth dwelling on because it is not like any other Zelda game.
Right. So the goal of each of these randomly arranged stages is to get every Link that's present from start to finish with the highest score possible. And in this case, the score being represented by rupees. The faster you get from the start to the finish, the larger rupee bonus you get at the end. Every death costs you rupees, and every subsequent death costs you more and more rupees. Having large quantities of rupees at the end is important, because at the end you are awarded with a key, and the type of key you get is determined by how many rupees you had when you finished. It's two levels and then a boss, I believe. If you get 1,000 rupees, you get a silver key, 3,000 is a gold key, and at 5,000 rubies, you get a hero key. If you complete the whole game with at those specific tiers, I believe it's called the first, second, and third epic, that kind of determines what final stage and what ending you get, with the kind of true ending being unlocked once you complete it with a hero key on every stage.
Yeah, pretty cool. Really kind of rewards replay. It also contributes to what is sort of a strange kind of hybrid competitive cooperative nature to this game, in that all the Links are working towards the same goal of defeating Vati, or, you know, whichever boss exists in the stage, but they're also competing with one another to get the highest number of rupees.
Yeah, because whichever player gets the highest amount of rupees at the end gets a medal. I think it's called the Medal of Courage. And once you've amassed a certain amount of those, you unlock a special move.
Yeah, pretty cool. It also makes it's one of the several reasons why the single player version doesn't quite work properly, because many of the rewards in the game are sort of rewarding you for competing against fellow Links, which if you're playing it single player falls a bit flat. How about tools, Spencer?
So tools. One thing I want to mention about tools in this game is that you, correct me if I'm wrong here again, but I believe you can only hold one tool at a time. So
yes.
Yep. So as you find the tools in these levels, you have to kind of swap out what you have available with what you find on the ground. Each player can hold a different tool, though, so it's helpful to kind of coordinate that between people.
Yeah, exactly. If you're, and this is one of the reasons why this works well in person with other players, is you can actually communicate verbally. But the each link can carry a different tool, which, as we'll get into with Four Swords Adventures, is a key distinction between these two similarly named games. But yeah, you discover the tools. You don't get them from from completing puzzles or getting halfway through a dungeon as you do in classic Zelda. You just tend to find them laying around the environment where you're going to need them to solve an environmental puzzle or defeat a particular enemy. And so you have to kind of prioritize which tool you're using at any given time, since you can only use one.
This game has the pretty standard spread of Zelda items. I don't know if we need to go into how the mechanics of the boomerang again. If you need to know about that, you should start listening to our podcast From the Start, available on iTunes, Spotify, and any place good podcasts are found.
There you go.
In addition to those, as we mentioned before, we have the Gnat Hat, which allows Link to shrink.
It's like the worst name, though.
I kind of like it.
You like gnats, do you?
No, but I like puns.
Well, yeah, it is a good pun. And I do like that they kind of end up making reference to it in Four Swords Adventures, where Ganon, spoiler for Four Swords Adventures, but Ganon threatens to crush Link like a gnat in Four Swords Adventures, which I think is kind of cute.
Mm-hmm.
The gnat hat's pretty cool. Go on.
Oh, no, you're good. I was just going to say that, mention that we also have the return of the magnet gloves from the Oracle games.
Yeah, their only subsequent reappearance.
One of the Oracle games. I forget which
one. Yeah, I'm going to look this up real quick because I feel like it's worth knowing. You ever run a Google search for magnet gloves?
Oh, I'm about to.
Well, mercifully, it's not pornographic, but it is, I guess this is a whole line of legitimate products. There's YouTube videos, you can DIY yourself an electromagnetic glove.
Check that out.
Yeah, I assume they work just like they do in The Legend of Zelda. Here we go. Magnetic gloves appear in The Oracle of Seasons. They work about the same here. Like a lot of Four Swords, it feels pretty shallow. The one sort of neat change that they made to them is that you can pull other links towards you with the magnet gloves. Pretty cool.
I'm sorry, one thing I had to note is that my absolute favorite boss of all time, Manhandler, shows up.
You love yourself some Manhandler, Hamilton.
Oh god, I will never not call out him. That name
they should
is
call it
fantastic.
They should call it Manhamla in your honor.
Oh, boy. That one was bad even for my taste.
Hey, that's what you come to Franchise Festival for.
Manhandla also shows up in Four Sword Adventures, but I didn't like him.
Oh, well, we're going to get around to that because I thought he was really cool.
Most of my arguments against Adventures boils down to, I think it's terrible single player, but I can see why it would be better if you play it as intended, but I'm getting ahead of myself, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with the same thing from what I can see. It's just like, it's in this day and age, it's almost impossible, really, to give it an accurate review, which I'm sure we'll cover later.
Yeah, exactly. Both of these games are very much a product of their times.
Mm-hmm.
You just got to have all your friends over that still have their GBA link cables to the GameCube.
Exactly. Yeah, you got to get four friends. You got to get four GBAs. You got to get four link cables. You got to get a Game Boy or a GameCube, and you got to get your sweet CRT monitor, and you got yourself a match made in heaven.
I think I'm the only person I knew in my hometown that had one of those GameCube GBA link cables, and that's only because one came included with Crystal Chronicles when I bought it.
Spencer, I'm right there with you. I had one. I had Crystal Chronicles, and I had that link cable.
I had Crystal Chronicles, too. That's funny.
Holy crap. We are the ideal group of three people to play this game.
It seems like a missed opportunity that we didn't.
Yeah, it's a shame. The pandemic makes fools of us all, as they say.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We can blame quarantine. I like that plan.
Yeah. Good. So with Four Swords Adventures, this game was released on the GameCube in Japan on March 8th, 2004, in North America on June 7th of the same year, and then in the European Union about 6 months later on January 7th, 2005. It surprised me quite a bit to find that this was developed internally by Nintendo EAD rather than Capcom. Because if you look at these two games, Four Swords and Four Swords Adventures, name aside, they're plainly drawing from the same visual well and the same mechanical well. Nintendo just took what Capcom had created for Four Swords and ran with it. So this was produced by Shigeru Miyamoto and Eiji Aonuma. This game, for all of its quirkiness, is extremely noteworthy for being Eiji Aonuma's first role as the Zelda series producer. The director of Four Swords Adventures, Toshiaki Suzuki, had previously served as director primarily on Mario adaptations. So these included Super Mario Bros. Deluxe from 1999, Super Mario Advance from 2001. The one that I'd like to dwell on here for a minute, though, was his directorial debut, BS Super Mario Bros. USA from 1996. That's Super Mario Bros. USA as in what American and European fans will know as Super Mario Bros. 2, the one with the turnips. The BS stands for, is a reference to the Satellaview peripheral for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, or I guess Super Famicom, as the Satellaview never came to North America or Europe. The Satellaview, I don't think we've talked about it on the podcast before, so apologies, listeners, if we're repeating ourselves. But the Satellaview is noteworthy as an exceptionally forward-looking and idiosyncratic piece of Japanese video game hardware, which allowed players to access remotely broadcast temporary versions of games. And so generally these were enhanced in some critical way. The Super Mario Bros. USA has, for example, a narrator, and features a character that doesn't appear in any other version of Super Mario Bros. 2. But the reason why this is relevant to a podcast covering The Legend of Zelda is that there were 2/3 Legend of Zelda games produced for the Satellaview. The first of these, really the first slash second, and we'll explain why in just a moment, is BS The Legend of Zelda from 1995. This was a full remake of the original Legend of Zelda quest, and a mostly faithful map, though it was shrunk from 8x16 screens to 8x8. They maintained the overall geography of the game and all of its dungeons. Though, of course, it is a bit shrunken. Rather than featuring Link as the main character, it features a male or female avatar from a different Satellaview game. Even though, this was kind of funny, I played BS The Legend of Zelda just a bit about a month ago, and I thought that the main character was Link, but it's because the male and female avatars of that other Satellaview game are clearly based on Link's Link to the Past design. Like, their overall body shape and eyes are all just Link's from Link to the Past. So the first iteration of BS The Legend of Zelda was broadcast through the Satellaview service in August 1995 for about 4 weeks, and that was the first map, the sort of the original quest from Legend of Zelda. The second was broadcast between December 1995 and January 1996, and that was based on the original Legend of Zelda's second quest. Both used a system, served as a debut for a system called SoundLink that allowed for an orchestrated soundtrack and a voiceover track that corresponded with the action on screen, which is pretty cool. BS The Legend of Zelda was followed up on with the Ancient Stone Tablets, a sort of pseudo-sequel to Link to the Past that was broadcast on the service in 1997. It features the Link to the Past's overworld map and game engine, but a bunch of new events, as the main character is the aforementioned avatars rather than Link, and it is meant to be finished in only 60 minutes. Players could only play it for 60 minutes any given day during its broadcast period, and its broadcast period was very brief in 97. Unfortunately, these games, they were once thought lost to time because of the sort of unique circumstances in which they were created. Actually, as recently as the 2011 Hyrule Historia, they were described as no longer available which is, you know, it seemed like kind of a shame when I got that book back in 2011. But as is often the case, enterprising emulation enthusiasts have saved these games from obscurity and made them available to play on, say, modern PCs through the magic of Super Nintendo emulators. Though, unfortunately, elements of them, for example, the voiceovers, are no longer available, since those were not encoded along the rest of the files.
Were you going to mention the third and fourth quest at all, or should I jump in with that?
Please jump in with that, because I don't remember that.
Yeah, so that was because of the popularity of the re-release of the original Legend of Zelda. They released a third and fourth version that the community came to know as Third and Fourth Quest, that in addition to rearranging the overworld, also rearranged some of the dungeons. I think Dungeon 3, or the dungeons in Third Quest, spelled out Saint Giga, which is the company that made this hotel of you. And then in Fourth
great.
Quest, the dungeon spelled out Nintendo.
Wow, that's really neat.
So Ancient Stone Tablets did something that was pretty forward-facing again with these kind of real-time synchronized events to people that were playing it. So, for example, as Chris mentioned, there'd be the one-hour window that you could play the game, and during that time, some guy might show up at a certain part of the map who's drowning, and you could hear him calling for help. And you'd have like a very small window to go to the source of that sound and find that guy, and then, you know, rescue him and essentially complete that quest and then get a reward for it.
Wow, really cool.
Yeah, so that's something that I think I don't play Fortnite, but I think Fortnite does that, and I can't think of many other games that really do that sort of one of you gotta be there to experience it synchronized kind of event in a game like that.
It sort of reminds me of the kind of things that they pioneered with like Ultima Online and then EverQuest and then World of Warcraft in the early 2000s.
That's true, but, you know, things like opening the gates of AQ in World of Warcraft and things like that, the difference in my mind is that those have kind of a longer window. Those are structured to be limited, but, you know, I think generally they were set up that players could learn about them
mm-hmm.
and then go participate in them within that time frame, whereas these seemed more like neat. You know, if you're there when it happens, then you get to experience this cool little unique thing and then it's gone sort of deal.
I think that speaks to the difference in the internet at the times that those two games existed, in that presumably, you know, even in a country that was a little bit ahead of the game on the internet, like Japan, there was not the degree of high-speed, rapid communication via the internet that would have facilitated players finding out about, you know, goofy NPC age drowning and telling other players to go there, that you would have needed to notice it in-game in this, as opposed to sort of later online RPG examples.
And did we mention that the BS Legend of Zelda remake of the original had updated graphics from the original?
Well? I don't think I explicitly did, but yeah, that's one of the things that's cool about it. In addition to the overworld being a little altered, the entire graphical palette's been updated, so it brings it more in line with Link to the Past, but it does have some unique sprites and everything as well. All right, well, let's chat about the development of Four Swords Adventures for just a few moments. Four Swords had been successful enough as a multiplayer portion of Link to the Past that Nintendo wanted to develop an entire game based on the concept for the GameCube. This is probably at least partially related to the fact that the GameCube was having kind of a hard commercial go of it early in its life cycle. For the same reason, Four Swords Adventures was conceived of as a way to sort of build on the much larger install base of the Game Boy Advance by having it kind of connect the Game Boy Advance experience and the GameCube experience. That said, one of the nice things about Four Swords Adventures, unlike Four Swords, is that, shockingly, only about 2 months before its release date, Miyamoto suggested a single-player mode to sort of sweeten the deal and make it so folks who didn't have an expensive and difficult-to-configure hardware setup could still enjoy the game. All of the level designs were redesigned in the span of about a month at the end of production to account for the possibility that somebody might play it single player using just a GameCube and a GameCube controller.
There's also not too much to this game's story either, but it's a little bit more in-depth than Four Swords. So let's get into it. There are six maidens who protect the Four Sword along with Hyrule in general. This game actually brings back Dark Link. For those who remember, he was in, I believe, Zelda 2, and was brought back in Ocarina of Time. In this game, he actually tricks Link into pulling out the Four Sword by locking Zelda up along with the six maidens in Dark Crystals.
Yeah, and it's not immediately apparent where Dark Link, or Shadow Link as he's referred to in this, comes from, but it will be by the end of the
game. Yes. And by pulling the sword out, he releases Vati back into the world. Now, pulling the sword out also creates four links, and those links must quest to stop Vati, hopefully once and for all. So the four links are incapacitated by Dark Link. Afterwards, they're awoken by the wise owl, Kepora Gebora. So the wise owl tells them that they must collect the force gems that are located around Hyrule to awaken the Four Swords' power and stop Dark Link. The links actually learn, through their quest, of the Realm of the Heavens, where Zelda is being held. And they learn this from the Green Maiden, once they save her. And he learns that, well, he, as in the four links, learns that they must gather the four royal jewels in order to reach said palace. Now, these jewels are held by four royal knights of Hyrule, and they eventually find them, and they all have been cursed by Vati. The links also learn that there might be a puppet master behind Vati. There's something else that's creeping around.
Is it Aghanim?
I think it's Tingle, Aghanim. Honestly. So eventually they reach the dark world of Hyrule, where they learn from the White Maiden, as they save her, that there's a mirror that belonged to an ancient tribe before the mirror itself was sealed away. They're not quite sure what the mirror did. It was thought, however, that the Dark Links might be coming from that mirror. Also, the name Ganon is mentioned, which alludes, perhaps, that this Dark King might have had a hand in all of this. Naturally, we find out. The temple where the mirror is kept had actually been stolen before the Links arrived there, as they quested to find what was going on behind the scenes. And they're told by the Red Maiden, as you save her, of a being known as Ganondorf, who hails from the Gerudo tribe. It's probably sounding familiar by this point. So to find out as his possible involvement in all of this, they head to the desert, where they find the mostly peaceful Gerudo tribe, who state that Ganondorf left for the sacred pyramids after flaunting their laws and looking for power. He also seemed to be holding a powerful ancient weapon, further cementing his quest for dominance. So eventually the Links find the jewels, they do free all the knights, and by doing so that allows them entry to the Realm of the Heavens. From there they rescue Zelda, they have their final confrontation with Dark Link, and they secure the mirror from him. Zelda uses her power to create a bridge of rainbows for the hero to enter the Palace of Winds. Once inside, they find the wind sorcerer Vati. They defeat him once and for all. Well, once more, we should say. Who knows if they'll bring him back one day. However, as they're escaping the crumbling palace, because the palace is run by magic, they encounter Ganondorf, who, of course, uses his power to take Zelda captive once again. Once he does so, he assumes the shape of a giant pig, as he typically does, and attacks the heroes.
Oh, yeah.
Together with Zelda and the four links, you do defeat the King of Darkness, and with the help of the maidens, you seal him within the Four Sword. And in typical Zelda fashion, the story ends with the links returning the blade with the imprisoned king inside it, and Link becomes one solid hero once again, which ends with a nice celebration of the darkness being conquered, and Link is crowned a hero.
Yeah, Link ends his journey into the cubist world of Nude descending a staircase and returns to a single unified form once more. Yeah, very cool.
And that is, yeah, that's the story of Four Swords Adventures.
Well, let's move on to the gameplay. How does that work out exactly in this game, Spencer?
All right. Well, like Four Swords, this is, in my opinion at least, predominantly designed to be played multiplayer, though there was more consideration given to being able to play through it by yourself.
Yeah.
There's the, it's called the Hylian Adventure, which is the kind of base game mode. This also adds a battle mode, which is a versus mode where the four links are kind of in an arena fighting one another. And also in the Japanese and Korean versions of the game, there was a mode called Navi Trackers, which had Japanese narration of Tetra, a la Wind Waker, which guided you through a labyrinth to try to find captured members of her pirate crew.
Just to dwell on that for a moment, one of the interesting things about the voice acting in this is that it is like fully spoken voice acting. So Tetra has a voice actress that narrates to the player where they need to be going. That would appear as well in the Korean version, and I suspect the necessity of voice acting to this and the you know, the comparative expense of hiring an English language voice actor and so forth is why this was cut out of the North American and European localizations. But it is pretty interesting because I don't believe Legend of Zelda would feature voice acting again until Breath of the Wild in 2017.
I'm racking my brains. I can't think of any specific examples either.
Moving on from Navi Trackers, what else you got for us, Spencer?
When doing Four Sword Adventure single player, you could just play with the GameCube controller. However, when you did multiplayer, I believe player one, in addition to all subsequent players, had to play with Game Boy Advances plugged in through the link cable.
Yeah, one thing that I'm not clear on with this is if player one had to also have a Game Boy Advance, or player one could play with a GameCube controller and the other three could use...
I believe in that case, player one still needed one.
Okay.
Because the idea there was whenever you went into certain caves or buildings, the gameplay for that character would switch to the Game Boy Advance screen so the other players could still move around on the map proper. If you're playing by yourself, that interface kind of shows up by popping up a fake Game Boy screen overlaying the normal one.
It's so cute.
On the TV.
It's a Game Boy Advance SP to
Yeah.
I love that.
I couldn't find anything concrete on it. I'm assuming this is how it works, because then if player one were to go in a building, in this case, with the GameCube controller, and that popped up, it would still prevent players two through four from being able to see and navigate the main screen.
That's a good point. Yeah, so it probably did require all four players to have Game Boy Advance.
Yep.
One of the interesting things is that the action continues on sort of the main screen behind the Game Boy Advance SP overlay, even in single player. Unlike any other Zelda game where the exterior simply ceases to exist when the player goes into an interior, in this case, you can still see characters kind of like moving around outside the building you're in. Or later on in the game, as you like phase between dimensions, you can still see what's going on in the home dimension as you're in like the parallel dimension, and so forth and so on. It's a pretty cool little twist that ends up having some gameplay implications, in that like you can fire arrows from an interior environment into an exterior environment, or throw bombs, and in fact you need to solve certain puzzles.
So in general, I think some of those mechanics are really neat. For example, there's a part when one of the Shadow Links throws a giant bomb on the screen, and then the only way to survive that is to hide on a Game Boy Advance screen, so moving into a cave or an interior, and then waiting until that bomb blows up and going back outside.
Yeah,
I ended up with a little bit of beef with the mechanic you mentioned, where you can shoot projectiles through doors onto the other screen, because I got really stuck on a puzzle that required that, because that's something that has never happened in a Zelda game, and the game doesn't really communicate that to you.
No, not even a little bit. Yeah, it basically requires you to be playing it multiplayer to know that's a thing that can happen.
Yeah, I found it at least pretty hard to intuit that throwing a bomb at a door to the next room will actually make that bomb go into the next room.
Yeah, I'm with you.
This keeps a similar sort of arcade structure to Four Swords, but with a little tweaks. So it's still it's not an overworld that you can freely walk around. It's levels that you select, and the goal is to kind of transition from the beginning of a level to the end of a level.
Yeah, and this one's even more linear than Four Swords in that you can't play the levels out of order. You need to play them in a specific one after another order.
Yep. Instead of shooting for score necessarily, you're trying to reach a certain threshold of force gems, which just replace rupees in this case. You have to accumulate 3,000 force gems over the course of a level in order to power up your sword, at which point, once your sword is powered up, you can break the barrier that is located at the end of a level. If you reach the end of that level and you have not powered up your sword, it actually teleports you back to the beginning of the level, so you can run back through and get more force gems.
Now, that's awful. Can I ask for a point of clarification real quick? You said 3,000 force gems, but I thought it was 2,000. I thought I got to 2,000 and it always powered up the sword.
2,000 sounds right. That might have been a typo on my end, and I just didn't catch it as I read it.
Oh, that's okay.
But between 2,000 and 3,000 force gems.
Yes, there you go. At some interval between those two points.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like that choice. Mercifully, once you reach the threshold, it does teleport you back to the end. You don't have to...
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so you don't have to at least, you know, collect 5 force gems at the start of a level and then complete the whole thing. It will send you back once you reach it, but it is a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah, I didn't encounter that, but only very narrowly made the threshold a few times. And you can lose force gems through by sustaining attacks from the boss at the end of stages. There are also sequences and stages where you encounter Tingle, who will float through on his balloon and compete with you to get some large number of force gems. So it's conceivable that you miss out on a pretty sizable portion of force gems because that little jerk steals them from you.
You're incentivized to explore, though, to get the force gems, because at least true. I didn't... Again, just full disclosure, I did not reach the end of this by the time we recorded it. But in general...
Oh yeah, let's be clear, I didn't either. I played through about a third of this game. Yeah.
In general, though, you're incentivized to explore, because when you kind of poke at the edges and discover hidden things, you're usually rewarded with either humongous caches of force gems, or item and weapon power-ups, or heart containers.
Yeah.
Heart containers in this game, I think, can max your health out at 6 hearts, and it resets at the beginning of every level.
Mm-hmm.
There is a life system, which is... Well, I would say kind of unique, except there's functionally a life system in original Four Swords just tied to losing
true,
your rupees.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, like, this is pretty much the only time, but yeah, I guess Four Swords as well, you're right.
Yeah. You find Force Fairies. If you get knocked down, the Force Fairies will bring your links back up. I didn't run out of them, but presumably if you do, that is a game over.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. Mercifully, they're pretty full. You do save the game at pretty regular intervals each time you beat one of the sort of 8 worlds.
Yes.
And each world, of course, consists of 3 stages. But I suppose if you run out of Force Fairies in the course of a world, you probably have to repeat the 3 stages.
I made a note here, it's a small thing, but the shoulder button roll returns from Minish Cap.
I did not discover this until the third world.
Yeah, I didn't use it that much here either.
Yeah, I just like hearing Link make his horrible little noise, so I used it as much as I could once I discovered it.
Turning from 4 swords, you can only carry 1 tool at a time. You kind of swap them out as you find them. Keys are also don't go in your inventory. Those are carried over your head a la Super Mario World. And then you have to stick them in the door that they unlock. This is probably less annoying when you're playing with 4 people, because when you're playing by yourself, whenever you swap a tool, all 4 links get that tool. And when you carry the key and you're trying to micro the other links, it's a little irritating and you kind of find yourself unable to do much useful action.
One of the interesting quirks that I discovered with this, and it was only through some experimentation, was that while all links gain the same tool anytime you pick a tool up, and this can become extremely tiresome in some of the stages that require swapping between tools quite a bit, since you'll need to return to different areas of the map to pick up tools that you need for advancement. Things like keys and moon pearls, which let you phase between different dimensions, and other sort of in-game artifacts that are not tools, can be carried by individual links in your group of four. So at one point, for example, in an early world, I had one link carrying a key and one link carrying a moon pearl, and the main link still using his tool to attack enemies.
Oh, so would you manually cycle to one of the other links, have them pick it up, and then press the recall button to put them in formation?
Exactly.
And they'd hold it? You know, I didn't really think to do that. I always just, I was usually in formation, and I mostly just grabbed the keys with Link Prime.
Well, in contrast to any other Zelda game around this time, you know, Wind Waker heavily tutorializes, Minish Cap would heavily tutorialize, but Four Swords Adventure barely tutorializes at all. It's pretty surprising the degree of experimentation that you need to do to sometimes figure out critical path advancement, but even sometimes to figure out, like, really even basic mechanics, like throwing items through doors or being able to pick up multiple artifacts. It's surprising that the game never teaches you that.
I guess since I just talked about formations and cycling through links, we may as well go into the mechanics for how you play this as a single player.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the formations are probably one of the more interesting parts of it.
Yeah. So by default, when you're doing this by yourself, you control just the one link in the green tunic and the others kind of follow behind you. You can press X to kind of cycle through and play individual links where you can just move them around and the other three will kind of stay sitting where they were. So you can do pretty precise positioning with that. Or you can press left shoulder or Y to bring up a formation menu, which allows you to automatically arrange the links either in a kind of a square, a cross, a horizontal line, or a vertical line.
The C-stick also maps to those four formations. So the up, right, down, and left on the C-stick instantly change your formation.
Ah, that would have been good to know. That would have been helpful.
If only the game tutorialized anything.
There's NPCs you can talk to that tell you about formation shortcuts in the form of
if you
hold Y or left shoulder and then move left stick, it'll shortcut to those. Maybe he didn't say C stick is mapped to those as well, or maybe I just missed it, but I didn't know C stick did it too.
Yeah.
When in the default state of the links just following you, they do not copy your actions, but when you're in formation, they do copy your actions. So you typically need most of the puzzles are going in combat are going to be solved by constantly managing what formation your links are in.
Yeah, it's pretty neat to swing like four swords simultaneously or throw boomerangs out in four directions at once. You can do some pretty neat tricks with the formations, but they also it's a risk reward prospect.
Yeah.
Because your links, your additional links are normally invincible when you're only controlling one link, but when you're in formation, all four can be damaged by enemies.
Even early in the game, I found it extremely difficult to avoid taking damage in formation in certain scenes. Like in particular, there's one when a lot of Zora pop up, River Zora, and they spit their iconic fireballs at you. And you need to kill them with a slingshot. And I kept trying to line my links up so I could shoot more slingshot bullets at once and wipe out more Zora simultaneously. But it was extremely difficult to have four characters in a line and still being able to dodge all those projectiles.
Absolutely. I think it's telling that they have an item in virtually every stage that halves the damage that you take. Yeah. I feel like that was probably a, given the short period of time in which this game was converted from a multiplayer only to single player experience, I suspect that item was one of the changes that made it so you would sustain less damage once you found it in each stage, because it's just too hard to avoid taking hits.
Again, probably not as much of an issue when playing multiplayer proper.
Of course, yeah. On a related note, there are much larger groups of enemies in this than any standard Legend of Zelda game. I guess, A, because it's a, you know, it's a 2D game on a comparatively powerful piece of hardware. So they could sort of fill up the screen with enemies in a way that they couldn't on the Super Nintendo. But also because you have so many links at your disposal, you can get into formation and sort of cut a swath through like 30 enemies at a time.
There were some moments where that was kind of fun. Other moments where it was a little less fun.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
As far as tools in Four Sword Adventure, again, there's nothing really stood out in particular. It's kind of the standard Zelda array. You got your flame rod for burning tree stumps, bombs, boomerang, bow and arrow. You got the rock feather instead of the rock's cape.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that this is the only game in the sort of three-game cycle of Four Swords, Four Swords Adventures, and Minish Cap that features the rock's cape rather than the rock's feather. I like to think that there was some, like, really intense dispute between Nintendo and Capcom. You know, like, Capcom said, no, it's got to be a cape. And Nintendo, for their single entry in the three-game cycle, said, well, we're going back to the rock's feather, thank you very much. One other note about the tools that I thought was really intriguing was that the fire rod in this works in the same way that fire would eventually in Breath of the Wild, which is to say that fire can spread from one flammable object to the next in a way that it could not in earlier Legend of Zelda games, which I thought was a really interesting and kind of prescient design choice that would sort of pay dividends quite a bit further down the line.
Boss number one is Phantom Ganon. Where have I seen this iteration of Phantom Ganon before? This is right out of Wind Waker, isn't it?
It's Wind Waker's Phantom Ganon, yeah. And Phantom Ganon reappears later on in this game, it's worth noting, in sort of a multiplied form. But, you know, it's pretty similar.
I was going to say Wind Waker, but then my brain, like, slammed on the brakes and wanted me to say Twilight Princess for some reason.
It's all right. We all got COVID brain nowadays.
Yeah. He kind of flies around. He has an attack, which I don't believe you can follow up on. You just have to dodge it, where he swings a sword at you. And then I think after every sword attack, he will fly toward the top of the screen and shoot an energy ball at you that you have to reflect back at him with your sword. After a certain amount of volleys, he'll eventually get hit by his own energy attack and fall to the ground, where he becomes vulnerable.
An Aghanim fight.
Yep. I found this kind of annoying single player. The trajectory of that sphere kind of veers off pretty far when he hits it. I assume the idea being that every individual player was supposed to be kind of running zone coverage on it.
And yeah, even, that's gotta be it, yeah.
Yeah, even when I ran the horizontal formation, sometimes the thing would go wide enough that I could not reach it in time. So I found the best way to do it was just stand as close as possible and just spam my sword swings. And that seemed to do the trick.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I did it the sort of traditional single player way of, like you said, having the horizontal or vertical formation, depending upon where I was in the arena compared to him.
The closer you stand, the easier it is, because then, you know, the less time it has to travel outside of your kind of zone of coverage. Mm-hmm. But
I didn't include the second boss here because I thought he was boring.
Yeah. Stone Argus?
Sure.
Yeah, we can skip him. He's just a floating stone eye. He's got some rocks around him. You throw a boomerang to get rid of the rocks. I'm going to backtrack to Manhandler real quick, even though it's a mini-boss, just because Hamilton brought it up earlier.
Yeah, mascot of the podcast, Manhandler.
You know, kind of a sphere with a pincer coming off of each cardinal direction of him as he moves around. The twist on him in this case is that each pincer is color-coded to one of the color tunics on each individual link, and each link has to hit the corresponding colored pincer.
Mm-hmm.
With four players, I think this is probably kind of a fun fight, but by yourself it's annoying because at this point, at least, I didn't know that if you only control one link, the other three are immune to damage. That's correct, right?
Right. Yep.
So at this point, I wasn't really aware of that. So this involved me going and parking my formation off in a corner, highlighting one, running it out, hitting the corresponding pincer, running it back into the corner and cycling to the next one, running it in, trying to hit the pincer.
Yeah.
See, this isn't the Manhandler I know and love.
Yeah, and you can't use the old trick of simply throwing a bomb into the middle of it from the original Legend of Zelda to just instantly defeat it.
Mm-mm. Manhandler is better than this. He knows it too.
Yeah, he'll be back in restored form in Hyrule Warriors coming later this season.
But moving on to the next proper boss, the Helmarok King.
Yeah.
Again, out of Wind Waker.
Yep. Exactly, yeah, straight out of Wind Waker.
Yep. This is the big bird. With a mask on its face that flies around. It starts the fight in Four Sword Adventure by kind of swooping down at Link and dropping rocks. in order to beat him here, you have to daze him with bombs first to destroy the mask, and then after that, you can just attack him with your sword.
You can also get him to fly into the buildings that are in the arena, and then his head is sticking through into the building. You go into the building with the mallet and smash at his head.
Oh, how about that?
Yep. Yeah, pretty wild.
Don't know that.
Kind of recalls the mallet's role from Wind Waker.
So the next boss proper, we have Big Poe or Jalhalla.
Yeah, I think it's Big Poe in the context of this game, but it is functionally, you know, looks the same and resembles Jalhalla from Wind Waker.
So this fight involves using torches to kind of keep the arena lit up. If the Big Poe gets caught in light, it'll stun it.
Mm-hmm.
At which point you can slash it with your swords.
This is pretty tricky in single player as well, I feel like, in that you really need to kind of separate your links and have them each... be prepared to be swapped between to light one of the torches.
You said it pretty well there. I don't have much to add to it.
Yeah. We can skip Moldorm if you want. It's not very interesting.
Yeah. This has some... I mean, this is a similar mechanic to Manhandle we brought up. He's got a weak spot on his rear end that changes colors, and you have to switch to the corresponding link to hit the right color. Also really annoying in single player, because at a certain point he will split in two.
Yep.
And if you have to micromanage one link at a time, corresponding to the weak spot, that's... I don't have any idea how you could manage that one link at a time, cycling through them one at a time, with two enemies moving around you have to manage.
It's all the fun of Moldorm from Link to the Past, which is to say no fun at all, but multiplied by two.
Yeah. We have Frostair. Kind of, you know, I can't believe we wanted to skip this guy. His name is a pun.
Frostair has a good name.
Or a portmanteau? Is that would that be a better word use here?
It's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. You know, it's a portmanteau that features a pun.
Yeah. So this is an
a frosty stair.
Exactly. You got it.
Yeah. This is basically just a big icy, platform with an eyeball coming out of it.
Yep. He's got some, like, stones or something, like, circling around him. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's attached to the ceiling. It releases miniature versions of itself. In order to beat it, you need to kind of navigate with the rock feather up to kind of the top of the room and make him detach.
This is played in a side-scroller perspective, it's worth noting.
Yes. And once he's detached from the top of the room, you can kind of jump on top of a platform and attack him with your sword.
My favorite detail of this fight is that the little links have little frosty breath coming out of them because the room is so cold.
That's adorable.
It really is.
After that, we've got Vadi.
Yeah.
Vadi in this game just has kind of his one form. It's the floating bat-like creature with the eye. There's a couple phases to this, though. Phase one, he has sort of a tornado following underneath him.
Yeah.
You need to throw bombs at the base of the tornado, which get carried up to the top, and stun him when he can be attacked. There are pits in the boss arena that you can fall down in, and when you fall down them, it loads you into a sub-area on the Game Boy Advance screen. They've got these cannons that you can climb into to shoot you out of. At a certain point, Vadi will be down there, and you want to beat him on this screen with your sword. I believe you can hit him with plunging attacks if you fall down in the pit on top of him.
It's in, it's in side-scrolling format, of course.
Yes. Once he comes back up top, he has these sort of swirling, these like black orbs that fly around him and kind of give him protection. In order to beat him in this phase, you need to shoot yourself up using the cannon from underneath in that pit room to get up above him and then hit him with a plunging attack up on this screen. And that should knock him down.
These cannons have a very, like, kind of Kirby vibe about them.
I was going to say Donkey Kong Country.
Oh, good call. Yeah, they're a little more Donkey Kong Country than they are Kirby. You're right.
Once you beat Vadi, of course, then you move on to the Pig King himself, Ganon.
Yeah, after a brief, like, echo of Ocarina of Time, where you're seemingly trying to escape a crumbling castle with Zelda, yeah.
About to say, like, when the castle falls down.
Yep. So, Ganon will shoot these like laser beams at you that you can dodge, hit him with your sword. He'll banish you to sort of a shadow realm where you have to fight Stalfos. That kind of Shadow Realm thing you get banished to, that pops up on your Game Boy Advance screen. Once you beat all them, you come back out to the boss arena. He's got a jumping attack, where he'll leap up in the air, and you can see his shadow, and you need to dodge that. That animation's kind of cool. He sort of swings his scepter like a helicopter blade to keep himself airborne.
Yeah, Ganon is this kind of interesting, like, amalgamation of several previous Ganons, particularly the Link to the Past and the kind of like Link's Awakening Shadow Ganon version.
Yep. At a certain point, he'll start throwing his kind of staff at you, too. It kind of spins around and tracks you, and you have to dodge that and keep hitting him. Rinse, repeat. Then there's a second phase where Zelda, you know, I guess, was Ocarina of Time the first time this happened, where Zelda kind of walks around at the bottom charging attacks to sort of help you beat the boss?
I believe so. The key difference here is that Zelda can be hit by Ganon's attacks.
Yep, you have to protect her.
This is a disastrous idea for a final boss fight. Just, it's worth noting, escort mission as final boss fight? Good lord.
Yeah, so single player, this is miserable because it is difficult. You can't really attack the boss and run interference for Zelda at the same time. As multiplayer, that's probably a lot more manageable, because you can just have two of your friends kind of sit back and protect Zelda from the projectiles while the other two keep damaging the boss. Here you really are just here you're just really biding your time until he just happens to come close enough for you to attack with your sword without moving out in front of Zelda.
Yeah, and more or less you're flinging his attacks back at him in that, again, that Aghanim style. Mm-hmm. And then eventually when Zelda powers up, you're able to launch an arrow at him through her attack, and it finishes him off.
Yep. And that's all the bosses, unless I miss something here.
No, and it's worth noting, one of the challenges that you run into with bosses here is that all of them sustain quite a bit more damage than traditional Zelda bosses, because it's assumed that there could be four of you fighting them. So they do maybe outstay their welcome a bit. All right, well, why don't we cover final impressions, folks? Hamilton, what did you think about Four Swords and Four Swords Adventures?
Admittedly, mine's going to be a little limited.
Sure.
Because it's just tough. Listeners, for those who are unaware, I currently have a Chromebook, which makes emulating games a little complicated.
And neither of these are even easy games to emulate.
Exactly. So it was a little bit complicated. I had to kind of go by my gameplay way in the past, and also kind of just kind of remembering the experience nowadays. So,
and Lord knows you did your homework. You know, you did a bunch of research with the encyclopedia and you know, various YouTube videos and so
exactly.
Forth.
You watch your Let's Plays, you watch your you read up on it. And again, I wanted a certain sense of like emotional connection to it, which is why I tried to remember how my experience was in the past, because I don't want to give listeners like my view of a game based on somebody else's gameplay of a view completely. I just don't think that would be fair to any of you. That being said, because of the complications, I would say I'm going to pull my experiences from back in the day. Now, I didn't play the one on GameCube, but I did play the one on Game Boy Advance, if you can believe that. And it was heavily based on how many people you can get, which is also heavily based on how many people had Game Boy Advances, which at least back in my day, which makes me sound super old, but hey, whatever. Not a lot of people had that and the game. So it was very complicated to get people together, but I managed to do that at least, and we had fun. And also, like, the reason why the story is not particularly that involved, because it's basically the meat of the game is you playing with other people. As for me, who, again, was kind of lucky enough to have multiple players do it back way back in the day, I had a lot of fun with it. Which brings me to my next point with Four Swords Adventures. So going by what I've watched, I think it sounds like it's an upgrade. And honestly, from what I watched, the gameplay actually seemed like a lot of fun. Chris and or Spencer, how was your impressions of the game?
I had polar opposite reactions to Four Swords and Four Swords Adventures. Four Swords, and I played the Anniversary Edition version on a 3DS. Four Swords is aggressively unfun. I did not enjoy for a second playing Four Swords. It is, it's plainly made to be played multiplayer. When playing in single player, you only get two links to manipulate, not four. And I twice came up against puzzles that I did not understand how to solve and didn't enjoy the game enough to figure out how to solve them.
This is where I also think it's important because, as I said, I was able to play with multiple players. But if you can't, it does sound like it's a fairly miserable experience.
Yes, yeah. I appreciate that they kind of dropped single player into it through sort of a backwards means, you know, nearly 10 years after its original release. I think it's neat that Nintendo tried to recover this from the past on the DS and 3DS as a way to get new players to experience something that was very interesting back in the early 2000s. But the truth of the matter was that I didn't even remotely enjoy it. Four Swords Adventure, on the other hand, I adored. I was not able to get through the entire thing in time for recording just due to, you know, some scheduling challenges and an especially truncated research period for this one. But, you know, made do with the time that we had available. And, you know, as we're all doing here in 2020. And just loved my time with it. There are some elements to it that are really needlessly opaque. And as Spencer pointed out, clearly designed for a multiplayer experience. But I found, like, the formation elements, I loved, like, the puzzle solving that required moving the four links into a specific formation, or alternately enemy encounters that benefited from moving Link into a specific formation, I got quite a kick out of. It makes you feel more powerful in a Legend of Zelda game than the series normally does when you can group the four links up into, like, you know, an outward facing cross formation, and as enemies come in at you, simply slash away at them, guarding sort of an internal space between the four links, and you know, defend yourself from a siege of dozens of enemies. I think until Hyrule Warriors, it would be the largest scale of any sort of Zelda combat, and I did get quite a kick out of both the visual spectacle of that and the mechanical spectacle of it. That said, the bosses really suffer from being played in single player, particularly as the game goes on. The bosses sustain so much damage and require so much coordination between where your various links are. I think the game works much better in its puzzle-solving portions than it does in its boss combat portions, and those are really kind of the weak link, if you will, of the Four Swords Adventures. But I'd love to see a modern-day re-release of this. I don't know how it would work. I think it would have worked really well on the Wii U. I don't know how it would work in sort of a post-Wii U era where multiple screens are not a given, but I would be curious to see something similar to this, maybe sort of in an expanded re-release someday. What do you think, Spencer?
I came off pretty negatively on this. And I tried to look at this sort of objectively, and most of the complaints I had, I imagine, are completely fixed by playing this multiplayer. So if somehow you have a setup where you can play Four Sword Adventures, you know, kind of as intended, I'd say go for it. I think you'll probably have a pretty good experience playing with your friends, and the game would seem a lot less tedious. I don't think it's worthwhile to do it by yourself. Because this abandons the normal Zelda structure and is something more akin to an arcade game, you kind of have to compare it to the contemporaries of that genre, I think.
Yeah, it almost doesn't even feel like a Zelda game, does it?
Yeah, no. And something like an arcade game where you are kind of I think there's a lot more emphasis on the core gameplay loop needing to be fun. And the gameplay loop here, when you're going through single player, is, I thought, intensely unfun. Because a lot of the puzzles are kind of revolve around a few things. Either navigating your links in a formation so that you can all kind of interact with an object at once, which it's tedious to manage the formation, I feel, and it can be, in some spaces, difficult or annoying to navigate through it while in formation.
Yeah, especially if, like, there are projectile-based enemies, heaven forbid.
Or it's a puzzle that involves all four links having to kind of spread up or spread out and do a separate action, in which case, you know, it's it takes four times as long as was probably designed, because instead of having each individual person doing their action, you have to go through and move and perform that action one at a time with each link. There is some needless backtracking and walking back and forth, as I think you mentioned earlier, because since you can only really have one tool equipped at a time, instead of having each link have an individual tool, you run into some situations where you have to go grab something, use it to solve a puzzle, and then backtrack to pick up the original tool before going back through.
I can think of at least one example where I ended up crisscrossing an area about 8 or 9 times to pick up tools that, by virtue of where other tools were, needed to be left at opposite ends of the area. It's sort of a village in the second world.
Same thing with the bosses. We kind of mentioned each specific boss, some of the issues that you run into when trying to do the single player, but I'm sorry. I found that that kind of tediousness and frustration of that gameplay loop did not make me want to go in and hack and slash through the enemies and get the force gems and, you know, kind of progress to the next level.
Were you kind of surprised when you heard that this was created by Nintendo as opposed to Capcom? Because this feels much more like a Capcom game than a Nintendo game.
Yes, it does. I was also very shocked when I saw that apparently this was ranked the 48th best Nintendo game by Nintendo Power.
That's bananas.
It's fascinating to me.
I really enjoyed this. Frankly, I like it more than the first two Legend of Zelda games. I might like it more than Oracle of Seasons. That's a bold pronouncement. But I also have an unreasonable love of Capcom action games, which can be kind of obtuse at times.
I could get behind saying this is better, at least holds up better than the original two Zelda games. I don't think this is better than Oracle of Seasons, not by a long shot.
Yeah, and with regard to the original two Zelda games, this is, like, clearly not as important as those. You know, those were much more historically significant as far as moving the medium forward. But, you know, minute for minute play-wise, I loved my time with this. But also, like, good gracious, it has some real rough edges that do not feel like Nintendo levels of polish. I suspect that's primarily because they reconfigured the game a month before it went into production, which is a really surprising last-minute move for Nintendo to do. But I guess the GameCube was, you know, that characterizes the GameCube era for Nintendo, doesn't it? That due to that really being their first platform that had some commercial pitfalls, they had to push things out a little faster than they normally would. Like we talked about in Wind Waker, where you know, there were pretty heavy portions that were cut to get the game out and into players' hands and boost those GameCube sales. Anyway, don't mean to cut you off, Spencer. Go on.
Oh no, that's kind of my concluding thoughts on it. I don't have too much to say about OG Four Swords, but at least nothing unique. A lot of the problems I had with Four Sword Adventures are kind of applicable to that as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how we respond to Triforce Heroes in a few months, since that is in many ways a refinement of the format that Nintendo pioneered here with about a decade's worth of internet connectivity and multiplayer experience under their belt. So that'll really be interesting to see how that shakes out for us in a few months.
I've heard nothing but bad things about Triforce Heroes.
I've played it and enjoyed it. I think that pretty well wraps up our coverage of the sort of peculiar multiplayer spin-offs of The Legend of Zelda in the early 2000s, as well as sort of a brief overview of the even stranger Satellaview entries in The Legend of Zelda catalog. I really appreciate you joining us for this this entry in Franchise Festival Season 1. As ever, this has been your hosts, Christian.
And I'm Hamilton.
And I'm Spencer.
And we hope you will visit franchisefestivalpodcast.com and give us your thoughts on the episode. Next time on Franchise Festival, we're going to be covering Twilight Princess. Our current plan is to cover that for 2 episodes in August 2020. Thanks for listening, folks. Goodbye.